Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Those of you who noticed, we have a little structure hanging out over there. Most of you have seen this before over the years. It's a similar structure. It's a booth, or a sukkah is the traditional phrase for it. As you note, our structure is a pop-up tent, but that's okay. And we have little species and such. In the command, we're not going to cover all this today. We're not. That's why I'm telling you about it now. We're covering something totally different. So I'm telling you the basics just so you're aware of them. So typically you have different species of plants you put on a sukkah. It includes from various fruit. Most of them are fruit-bearing plants, but they don't have to be. We have willow, which is the commandment of God. Of course, he instructs us to use willows. There's myrtles, palms, and good fruit type of product, hence the citron or the etrog, same product, two different words. There's also some fruit trees. We put some fig on there and the tomato that Anne brought, a few other things there too as well. Decorate your sukkahs with those things. They are fruit-bearing things. There's olive as well. There's even some little olive buds too on some of them, little olives. But the idea is that good fruit-bearing or good fruit is part of the sukkah, and the intent is that you produce good actions or good things. Your task, the things that God's given you to produce good fruit, so the bearing a tree that bears good fruit, and that the whole, you've heard those terms before, the bear good fruit, that your actions, what you do is good versus that which is bad or not valuable. What is not valuable is cut down and burned up. Messiah has spoken about that parable multiple times, that instruction. And the good fruit is one that produces something that's beneficial or valuable, and God will enjoy the fruit of that labor, his labor inside of you. Hence, we have them on our sukkahs. So your question about those basic symbols, I'm not covering the great details today. I'm going to talk about something a little different, but make sure you don't forget those are part of the Sukkot tradition and components that God commanded. All right? Okay. That was my little spiel today, after I cover all my basics. It's important to cover the basics. If you forget things, I don't want to meet God. Good. Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's a temporary time period, right? Yes. We should be talking about that. That will be one of our topics today, one of our discussions regarding Sukkot. All right. So we're going to start out, of course, for Sukkot. And as is where the instruction is given to us for Sukkot, well, actually given to us a couple of different places, but the most common one I go to is Leviticus 23. Just remember, we're all on the same page. We all have the same tools to work with when we're discussing topics. So just Leviticus 23, just read this portion. We'll go to other areas later on, shortly actually. Leviticus 23, the command or instructions for Sukkot shows up in verse 33 of Leviticus 23. It says, Yehovah spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, saying, On the 15th day of this seventh month is the festival of Sukkot, a seven-day period for Yehovah. On the first day is a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work. For a seven-day period, you shall offer a fire offering to Yehovah. On the eighth day, there should be a holy convocation for you. You shall offer a fire offering to Yehovah. It is an assembly. You shall not do any laborious work. These are the appointed festivals of Yehovah that you shall proclaim as holy convocations to offer a fire offering to Yehovah, a burnt offering, its meal offering, a feast offering, its libation, each day's requirement on its day. Aside from Yehovah's Shabbats, and aside from your gifts, aside from all your vows, aside from all your freewill offerings, which you will present to Yehovah. But on the 15th day of the seventh month, when you gather the crop of the land, you shall celebrate Yehovah's festival for a seven-day period. The first day is a rest day. The eighth day is a rest day. You shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of a it's a citron or a good tree, good fruitly tree, the branches of a date palms, twigs of plaited tree, and brooks of willow. You shall rejoice before Jehovah your God for a 7-day period. You shall celebrate as a festival for Jehovah a 7-day period in the year, an eternal decree for your generations. In the 7th month you shall celebrate it. You shall dwell in booths for a 7-day period. Every native in Israel shall dwell in booths, so that your generations will know that I caused the children of Israel to dwell in booths when I took them from the land of Egypt. I am Jehovah, your God. And Moses declared the appointed festivals of Jehovah to the children of Israel. And that is where our instruction, initial major instruction, comes from, Sukkot, or how we get it, where we get the commandments to do it, as well as its timing and the components involved with it. I have a few comments to say about this. First of all, I have this little mark up here. I get to draw. So if you notice, we're discussing a little bit about today. Sukkot has two primary broken down topics, right? The first topic, which you'll read, you've read here, we just read, discusses a festival. I'm going to abbreviate because I don't do the word festival very well. And then we have, how do you spell festival? F-E-A-S-I. We'll try that again. F-E-S-T-I-V-A-L. Close. Hey. It's all screwy. Because I get the word with feast, and feast is spelled differently. That has an E-A, right? It's always because it messed up. Yeah, a lot of it is just called a fest. It would be easier for me to understand. Feast and a festive feast. And then we have the other section. The festival, of course, first of all, before I go to the other section, festival, what is a festival or a feast? Hence, which is the topic. It's a party, right? An event you do things with. You have food, typically. You have music, if there is any. You have people gathered together. It's a festival, a celebration, right? Spells in the form of a celebration. I'm going to abbreviate, because again, spelling is weak. Then we have the other category, which is the components associated with it, all right? So, for example, is Passover a festival?
No.
Is these unleavened bread a festival? No. Yes, they are. Actually, both are.
Oh, that's right. That's a book. They're bookends.
Well, in the fact that a festival, do you celebrate at Passover?
Yes.
So is it a festival? Yes. Okay, good.
Right.
English words here. Okay. So, okay. So I get it. I know that it's a memorial, memorials as well.
Yeah.
But you are celebrating, and there are people involved, right? It's usually your family, and I have yet to see a festival that does not involve food, but I'm sure there probably is one. Now, there is obviously Day of Atonement, but even that involves food when you're ending it, the lack of food. The festivals are the celebration component of an event, whatever event is to celebrate. Now, there are components that are associated specifically to certain festivals. Now, for example, so we talk about this. We talk about Passover, it's an easy one. Can you name at least one or two components associated with that particular festival? Matzah, that's a good one. So there's the components. I'll put components over here. I can't spell components, so it's just calm. Matzah. Wine, which is not a Torah command, but it is a traditional command. We'll put wine down here as well. It is a tradition to have wine at Passover. We have lamb too, so we put like some kind of a lamb associated, some food associated with that. And a story. Because a story is really important. That was actually what God specifically said, you shall tell them. It is a story, command a story. So there, what was that?
Bitter herbs,
right? There are herbs, or herbs. Blood, talking about blood in particular. So we have, there are components associated with a festival, right? Now this is an easy one because it happens to do with Passover. The celebration itself mostly is centered around food and eating. Because what are we doing at Passover? we're eating. We're talking. There's associated of human interaction. There's stuff going on for festivals and festivities, activities, and there's also the components associated with them. God's appointed times are broken up in this basic pattern. There's a celebration of some form, and there's components to go with it, right? And that helps us because otherwise, if you would notice, if God did not specify components, would not all holidays look the same? Yes. They would look the same as Shabbat. If, for example, here's another example which is easy to understand. Imagine you did not have a Shabbat. Would not Saturday look the same as every other day of the week then? Yes, they look the same. Whatever it was, there was no distinction, right? So we have distinctions that God set aside. Characteristics is a good example for it. Characteristics is the name for it. So we have festivals, we have components. In Sukkot, since we're talking about Sukkot is our topic today, we have our festival components. We also have our, as far as our festival, we also have the components themselves. So in Sukkot, I'm going to abbreviate. Festival. It helps to have a cheat sheet. So, festival and components. So, in Sukkot, we'll write this here, Sukkot. Sukkot. I can spell that word, sort of.
Yeah.
I don't know how I get that one right. Oh, well. So, we have Sukkot. What are the components for Sukkot? We talked about it briefly as before I discussed my topic. But in the Torah command, what are the components for Sukkot? We just read it in Leviticus. Can you rattle off to me? What is some of the components?
To go to a specified place.
That's true. It's not in this part of the command. That is true. It's earlier on in the chapter of Leviticus. Discusses where he puts his name. We'll discuss the place in a moment because that's important in about 20 minutes from now. We'll talk about the place. In the components of the command, which we read here in Leviticus 23, it says, obviously no laborious work, right? Which that's because with all the holy days, but in this particular thing, it says on the 15th day you should. This is a verse 40. You should take for yourselves a first the fruit of a tree, a citron tree, a branch of date palms, twigs of a plaited tree, which is translated as a myrtle, and brooks of a willow. So we have tree components and bushes. Tree and bush parts. And of course, we have obviously the time slot here as far as the timing and the festival for a 7-day period. So the festival side is 7 days long. But we also have here specified on the 8th day. So it's 7 days plus one. So we have an 8th day as well. We'll discuss 8th day probably, maybe, well, actually, I won't talk about it all today because I'm too busy. But we may talk about it later on in the feast. We'll see. So, of course, obviously these components. Now, if we look in our Tanakh, the entire Old Testament, we notice that the prophets break their conversation about Sukkot into two separate categories. They either talk about the festival part, the celebration part of it, components of it, or they talk about the component parts of it, right? Because they talk about two different things about Sukkot. So we'll read some of them today and what they have to say regarding Sukkot and what their opinions are. First of all, we're going to jump to the component side first, and we'll discuss the festival side second. So component side, we'll jump to Nehemiah. It's an important, and by the way, I am not covering in great detail all the elements of Sukkot. We're just discussing these as we're skimming through quickly to cover the basic ideas of it. So Nehemiah chapter 8 discusses this, which is a component side more so than a festivity side. So it says on Isaiah chapter 8, starting in verse... Sorry, Isaiah, I apologize. Nehemiah chapter 8. I misspoke. It's Nehemiah chapter 8. We're jumping in the middle of a reciting of the law. So Ezra has been up there reading the Torah for a number of days. And as we're going through, he gets a certain section of it. The people, of course, are trying to listen in their respective languages. Note, they do not speak or understand Hebrew very well anymore at this time in their history. But Ezra reads Hebrew, so the people themselves have to have it translated for them in their own language. personal languages. So in this case, it is Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 9. It says, Nehemiah, who was a governor, Ezra the priest, the scribe, and the Levites who taught the people, said to the people, this day is holy to Jehovah your God. Do not mourn nor weep, for all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. He said, go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared. For this day is holy to Jehovah. Do not sorrow, for the joy of Jehovah is your strength. So the Levites quieted all the people, saying, be still, the day is holy, do not be grieved. And all the people went their way to eat and to drink, to send portions and to rejoice greatly, because they understood the words that were declared to them. Now the second day, the heads of the fathers of houses of all the people with the priests and Levites were gathered to Ezra the scribe in order to understand the words of the law. They had written the law which Jehovah had commanded Moses, that the children of Israel should dwell in booths during the feast of the seventh month. And they should announce and proclaim in all their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, go out to the mountain, bring olive branches and branches of oil trees and myrtle branches and palm branches and branches of leafy trees to make booths as it is written. When the people went out and brought them, they made booths for them, each one on the roof upon his house or in their courtyard or the court of the house of God and in the open square of the water gate, the open square of the great gate of Ephraim. So the whole congregation of those who had returned from the captivity made booths. And they sat in their booths for since the days of Joshua, son of Nun, until that day, the children of Israel had not done so, and there was very great gladness. And also day by day, from the first day to the last day, he read from the book of the law of God, and they kept the feast 7 days. The eighth day, there was a sacred assembly according to the prescribed manner. Now, in this section of Nehemiah, you notice, although they do mention it's a festival, what is the primary drive or primary topic being discussed for Nehemiah? It's an act of what the people did, isn't it? What did they wind up doing? Well, they went out, that they heard what was going on. They were sorrowful at first because they had not been doing these things. It's a celebration day. Don't worry about that. We're still celebrating. But what they do, they responded by doing something. And they got the component side, in this case is bushes and trees and such. And the component side, and they brought them to where they could put and put together their sukkahs, their booths, what they would put together. So in Nehemiah, you know, as most of his thrust, his discussion, his topic, focused on the components, the tree components, the branches, and they built booths. And the people dwelled in them for the 7 days. And they dwelt to dwell. Oops. Now, he did not focus most of the attention on the festivity side. Now, he did mention the fact that they shared food. But that wasn't the primary directive of his instruction. Now you contrast that to the previous account, the last time they celebrated Sukkot, that is recorded, by the way. Note, there are a lot of things that happen in the Torah that aren't recorded, in the Tanakh, the events that weren't written down because they happen all the time. People didn't write them down every year. But if we go back to both in Kings as well as in Chronicles, it says the last discussion, last time this topic was brought up, in the book of Kings, it is Kings, 1 Kings chapter, somewhere in here, wrote down the exact verse, chapter 8, 1 Kings chapter 8. Now in this particular event for chapter 8, this is not concerning the components of Sukkot, but rather the festivity side of Sukkot. These are two different topics, right? So they're addressed two different ways. So the festivity side of Sukkot, in 1 Kings chapter 8, Solomon finishes building the temple, he's being dedicating it to God, and the Ark of the Covenant, of course, comes into the temple, and they're all happy and proud. This is a great, great, glorious time. In 1 Kings chapter 8, it discusses, starting in verse 1, it goes beginning of here, it says, Solomon assembled the elders of Israel, all the heads of tribes, the chief fathers, children of Israel, to the King Solomon in Jerusalem, that they might bring up the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah from the city of David, which is Zion. And all the men of Israel assembled to King Solomon at the feast of the month in Etanim, which is the seventh month. Then all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark, and they brought up the ark of the Lord, of Jehovah the Lord, the tabernacle of meeting, and all the holy furnishings that were in the tabernacle. The priests and Levites brought them up. Also King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who were assembled to him were before the ark, sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be counted for the number of the multitude. The priest brought the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah to its place in the inner sanctuary of the temple, the most holy place under the wings of the cherubim. The cherubim spread their wings two over the place of the Ark, and the cherubim overshadowed the Ark and its poles. The pole extended so that the ends of the poles could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen from the outside. So they are there to this day. There was nothing in the Ark except the two tablets of stone which Moses put there at Horeb, when Jehovah had made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. It came to pass, the priests came out of the holy place, the cloud filled the house of Jehovah. The priests could not continue ministering because the cloud for the glory of Jehovah had filled the house of the Lord. Then Solomon spoke, Jehovah said he would dwell in the dark cloud. I have actually built you an exalted house, a place for you to dwell in forever. Now, in this account here, we have obviously a discussion as far as the ark being brought, as far as how this process was supposed to occur in the event. Now, I'm going to go through all of Solomon's prayer because it gets a bit lengthy. But toward the tail end of chapter 8, the last half of it, it discusses in verse 62, we continue on at the end of his conversation with God, chapter 8, verse 62, it says, then the king and all the Israel made him offered sacrifice before Jehovah, and Solomon offered a sacrifice of peace offerings, which he offered to Jehovah, 22,000 bulls, 120,000 sheep. So the king and all of Israel dedicated the house of Jehovah. On the same day, the king consecrated the middle of the court that was in the front of the house, the Lord, for there he offered burnt offerings, grain offerings, and the fat of peace offerings. Because the bronze altar was before Jehovah, was too small to receive the burnt offerings, the grain offerings, the fat of the peace offerings. At that time, Solomon held a feast, and all of Israel with him, a great congregation for the edge of the Hamath, the brook of Egypt, before Jehovah, our God, for 7 days, and 7 more days, 14 days total. On the 8th day, he sent the people away, and he blessed the king, and they blessed the king, and went to their tents joyful and glad of heart for all the goodness that Jehovah had done for his servant David and for his people Israel. Was there any mention of the components for Sukkot in here at all? No. Sort of.
Well, there was a lot of offerings.
Sort of. Now, there's no components listed, right? I didn't see branches and trees and nothing of that stuff.
No.
The 8th day is mentioned. Yeah, that's a party. But it's not really a component per se. There is some mention in the fact that, well, we understand what a booth is. We understand what a temple is. You could argue that there is some kind of component association there, that fact that God was putting himself into a temple, a physical structure, which could not actually be containing him, but that's okay. So in 1 Kings, my marker here, in 1 Kings 8, it's probably this event is also recorded again in 2 Chronicles 7. So in 2 Chronicles 7 also discusses this particular event. 1 Kings 8 is mostly on the festival side of events, right? It's not so much on the component side, but it is a festival side of recording of events. Just because Chronicles records it just a hair different. We jump to Chronicles 7, just to read. It's a small section here. As Second Chronicles 7, verse 8, it says, at that time Solomon kept the feast 7 days, all Israel with him, a very great congregation, for the entrance of Hamath, the brook of Egypt. Verse 9 says, on the 8th day they held a sacred assembly, for they observed the dedication of the altar 7 days and the feast 7 days. On the 23rd day of the 7th month, he sent the people away to their tents, joyful and glad of heart, and the goodness that Jehovah had done for David, for Solomon, for his people. Thus Solomon finished the house of Jehovah, the king's house, and Solomon successfully accomplished all that came into his heart to make the house of Jehovah in his own home. So that, of course, records obviously the time slot in these specific dates. Again, no mention of components. So we have these two basic breakdowns of what is a component versus what is a celebration. Now, if we look at this more thoroughly, we'll also notice back in Leviticus 23, it had focused a little bit about both festival and Sukkot, the components. So Leviticus 23 talks about obviously these components, booths, trees, and bushes, and all the various dwelling times. It also talks about festivals too, but Kings focuses mostly on festivals. He's not the only time it's focused that way. If we look at the book of Numbers, which is what the next part of our Torah portion discusses. It discusses also this event, but note what it is, what it has and what it does not have. In Numbers 29, it discusses the tabernacle, the festival of Sukkot. I'm not going to read the entire thing, but I'll give you the first few verses. You'll get the gist of what's going on here. This is Numbers 29, chapter 29, verse 12. It says, on the 15th day of the seventh month, you shall offer a holy convocation. You should no custom work on it. You shall keep the feast of the Lord 7 days. You present a burnt offering, an offering by fire of sweet aroma to the Lord, 13 young bulls, 2 rams, 14 lambs, first year, they shall be without blemish. The grain offering should be fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of ephah for each 13 bulls, 2/10 for each of the rams, 1/10 for each of the 14 lambs. Also 1 kid of the goats, the sin offering, besides a regular burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering. Note, this repeats with a subtraction of a bull each day. Verse 17, continues on, it's at 6th day number 2, do the same thing, except minus 1 bull. The whole section, reading of chapter 29 of Numbers, it does not talk about components other than the animals being offered, right? Now, those are still components, but those components are used on nearly every holiday. You have bulls, goats, lambs, they're offered almost every holiday. Nothing really changes, nothing specific or unique to Sukkot. So even Numbers, I put over here, Numbers 29, focus more of all on the event of, because mind you, most of these animals are eaten. You're celebrating with this time period. Numbers 29, I put it in the category of festival. I do realize it does have some animal components. Oops. Which we can argue are components, even though they're not unique to Sukkot. They're more generic components, what's being offered. It also has grain offerings, also not unique to Sukkot. They're just a grain offering, which is applied to all festival holidays. So we have these different groups. We have, obviously, we have the festival components, which is from Kings and Numbers and a little bit from Leviticus. We have the non-festival, the actual parts, the pieces, the symbols, obviously in the Leviticus 23 and, of course, obviously in Nehemiah. I didn't write that down. That was in chapter 8, verse 9 to the end of the chapter. Those are components. So I have a question for you. God had commanded something strange in Leviticus 23 when we read it. Hopefully you noticed that. One of the strange things he asked was that we remember to dwell in these booths for a time period. And he gave us his reasons why. Do you remember what his reasons were? What his reasons were that he wanted us to focus our attention on these components, this booth idea? What reason was it? What did he give to us? Do you remember what it was? We had read it. That he made the children of Israel dwell in tents. So that was his purpose behind the component side, right? Get all these pieces together, worship for 7 days, dwell in booths, and so you remember, I had people many, many moons ago dwell in tents. Does anybody here not know that? Do we understand that the people came out of Egypt, that they actually were dwelling in tents and they were wandering for a while? Do you know how we know that? The Torah says so, right? That's how we know it. So is the act of dwelling in tents tell us that? Or is the act of reading about it tell us that? Reading about it. Because I can dwell in a tent, I have no clue why I'm doing it. But I can read about it. Hey, this is why. So it's the act of reading that reminds me, the act of understanding, being taught what happened. That's what reminds me that I remember what happened. The act of only a tent doesn't do that for me. It doesn't really do it for anybody. Because how many have been camping and wouldn't think about the Israelites? Well, we've done that over the years. We're little kids going home. You focus on how cold it is, right? Go home where it's clean, a clean shower. But we can dwell in tents and booths and not necessarily think of or associate with the Israelites that moment in time. Yes, Jeff.
Well, I grew up with a tradition that took a number of the remembrances of Israel, all the celebrations, the festivals, very cerebrally.
Right, inside your head only.
Quite a big difference when you actually go through and live them out to as much as we can today. big difference.
Yeah.
That disconnect between your head and, you know, what you actually connect with emotionally is hugely different.
And we have to ask ourselves, why is that? What is it that God built inside of us that we can dwell in? We could go camping and not think of the Israelites, but how many of you can dwell in one of those things over there, the booths over there, and not think about what it is? Good note, do any of you go camping in one of those? No. Why? Well, look, it's all drafty. All the bushes, how many bugs? I gotta sleep with all the bugs that could crawl over me. No, thank you. I'd rather have a tent that protects me from all the elements I don't want to be dealing with. So we don't dwell in them for our camping trips, do we? Well, I don't. I wouldn't want to. It's not very comfortable at all. But I would know what it was if I was dwelling in it, because this isn't normal. This is a strange structure. So God built within inside us, we can do something, hence camping, and not understand or think at all about him. Or we could do something else, a form of camping, and only think about him, because that's all we think about, none of those things. It's like, God, why'd you have me do this? This is cold. Have you thought about heaters? Anything? some extra few extra walls, insulation, you know, there's a reason we have, you know, 4 and 6 and 8 inch walls. We're not dumb. We keep ourselves from getting frozen to death. So we can associate certain things at certain times and other things at other times, even though it's the same thing. It's the same camping experience. But we associate it certain times. We say, I know what this is versus I know what that is. It's the same element, same component, same idea, because the timing and its appearance, we have two different definitions. Yes, your hand was up.
Yes. In Israel, they say it's very odd for the people there to go into these structures in at this time of year because it starts getting very cold. But they have a method, you know. They have they have big boards that they use. I mean, you know, they put together like a real hut.
Right. Temporary.
Right. And they do have like a little ceiling that they can look at the stars, you know. Mm-hmm. And they have the plants over it. But they have big boards that don't have cracks in it, mm-hmm. or, you know, tarps or whatever.
Right.
So that makes a difference. But, I mean, it's the frailty of life. It's the frailty of our bodies, you know. We really can't dwell out there. You know, it just reminds us of how we need the Lord.
It makes us curious. So it reminds us of our frailties, which we'll get into that shortly as we get a little further on into our discussion today. Yet the Israelites did their frailty for 40 years. I'm honest, 40 years. It's a long frailty time. That tent is not so, let's say, not so flimsy. If I was carrying it around, I'd make it lightweight. So it's easy to carry because it's really heavy. Easy to put up, easy to take down because I'm hauling around it as it records. Sometimes the Lord stayed for a day, sometimes for a week or a month at a given spot. He would transfer. You'd be ready to get up and go quickly. You wouldn't want a full structure that takes you three days to put up or a week or two or even a month. It wouldn't work so well. So they did it for 40 years. That was their dwelling experience. And we, of course, we balk after about 7 days. Okay, God, I'm kind of tired of this. Actually, most of us probably don't even see the night in one of them. I know I don't. It's too cold. I sleep in my room, in my bed. Most of us do as well. We don't want to stay in them overnight because it's just not very comfortable. Right. It isn't very comfortable.
Have you gone out to your campground yet?
No, not yet. We'll go to it tomorrow. The day of the campground. It isn't comfortable. It's not meant to be comfortable, is it?
No.
It's meant to be miserable.
We'll
discuss our lives today. We'll discuss a little bit about that. So, I have a question for you regarding this topic. So, it's not meant to be comfortable. So, how celebratory are you? I believe Rose mentioned earlier, what you think about going home, right? So, it's not supposed to be comfortable. So, it's an uncomfortable experience. But yet, God says, celebrate. Really? I mean, a heater I'd celebrate for. Thank you, God, I got a heater, right? I'll put a bigger campfire on the side, a few extra blankets. I can celebrate for those components, right?
It's a celebration of future time.
What are we celebrating for? Yes, Daniel.
So
when the people of old were bringing their sacrifices to the temple, was there songs that they were celebrating as they were giving them?
Yes, that's an interesting point. Yes, there is a method by which humans tend to get our emotional state into a celebratory mood. All right? Most of us are familiar with singing or with songs in general. Have you ever had a bad mood? You turn a song on, it makes you feel better? Right. Or were you in a bad mood, sort of song made you feel worse, you shut it back off again? Yeah, oops. I don't listen to that. That sounds terrible. Or change the radio. So we understand that when we want to change our mood, change our mental, sorry, emotional state of being to a from a miserable state to a celebratory state, we put a song on. Whatever the song may be, maybe it's a, whatever, it doesn't make a difference. It's a song of some form. We start singing, we change it, and it affects inside of our hearts what we're doing and how we view things. So we're dealing with a celebratory mood, and in this case, which we're in a miserable experience, dwelling in a sukkah for 40 years, what do we do to make ourselves feel better? We sing.
So it was built into the festival.
Yeah, it built... The song, yeah, the emotional celebration is part of it. Now, I realize that it's not commanded that you will sing, but in the practices being given, and the psalmist, of course, records abundance of them, that songs were a common experience. Now, in the case of Nehemiah, which you did not read the entire section, it says they had the psalmists were there from sons of Asaph that were singing during these events. So they had, I don't know how many they had, a few dozen, a few hundred, I don't know, all singing songs, at probably a nice chorus, I'm not sure, as they were traveling along doing these various activities. So they have these events and things going on to increase the mood of celebration, even though it's not a very pleasant experience. It changes your mood, your viewpoint. Yes.
Well, they did sing psalms because they sang Psalm 120 all on the first day, all the way up. When they were in the temple, there were 15
stairs.
The
songs of ascent, right.
There were 15 stairs to get up there. And they went all the way to Psalm 134.
Right.
So the songs they sang on each stair.
So those events, those designed to create mood. Now, fortunately, in their experience, yes, Tammy, their experience in that event, they were there at the temple. So most of them were not wandering in 40 years of wilderness at that point in time, because this is obviously many, many generations later. But the idea of changing your mood to make something which is miserable, in this case, a dwelling in a sukkah, to be a celebratory event, they used music to do that, was one of the components used. Yes, Tammy.
Well, the special foods, like when you go camping, what is the American stereotypical camping food that if you don't have it when you're camping, you don't feel like you're camping?
Well, it's usually hot dogs or s'mores.
Hot dogs, s'mores. I mean, there's certain foods, stuff you can cook on a fire, right?
Right. This is how you cook an open flame.
So you were saying earlier about how, you know, oftentimes living in a sukkah can be miserable, particularly if you live in a climate like ours where it gets cold and wet. Cold and wet at night. Is there's another command though about Sukkot that people forget about? Is that there's also the command, for lack of a better phrase, command, is to have strong drink.
Right.
Well, when you've had some strong drink in you, you're pretty warm.
You don't feel so bad. And it also changes your mood at the same time. I'm sure most of you have heard the old cliche of the drinking party, drinking songs. The same idea. So you can change your mood and change your opinion of it pretty quickly if you're a little toasty in that respect. So as we go to these topics, so we have these components that are not necessarily pleasant things. I mean, there's fruit and such as, but the moving dwelling part isn't so pleasant. We also have the festival side to make it a pleasant experience anyway. So we have all these elements we have combined that God has said, this is the reason you're going to do this, to remember that I had them dwell in these booths, these temporary dwellings for this period of time. We have this command, of course. We do not have this command on all holy days. Do you notice that? We do not have a command for Shavuot, for example, that you will cleanse yourself for 3 days in remembrance of the time which I gave the Torah. No. You don't have the command that you will blow trumpets on trumpet because the time I did something, which is not listed. But we do have one for Sukkot. That God specifically gave the reason, and I want you to remember what happened a long, long, long time ago. I want you to remember what they did and what they experienced. So the purpose for these events, though they may be miserable at times or celebratory, if you happen to be a little toasty, They are designed to remember something. Remember somebody who died a long time ago. Your ancestors, your forefathers. Why is that important to him? Because we forget them. How many of you know what your great-grandparents' lives were like?
We found out about it last week.
You power went out. Yeah, the power went out. You found out what life was like at great-grandparents. How about your ancestors of 200 years ago? 300? Do you know their names? No.
I have an app for that.
You have an app for that, yeah. find the names. We don't remember them, do we? Because we don't know. We don't remember. Were their lives pleasant or hard?
Hard.
We think it was hard, but you don't know. You weren't there. Maybe your great whatever were kings or queens, and their life was easy. I don't know. I wish. A little inheritance kickback, will you? We don't know anything about them. If you were back in time and asked them, they say yes, it was great, or no, it was terrible, or all these various good or bad things they experienced. We don't know. Because we forgot them. Now, a question for you. What was the life like for the Israelites wandering the wilderness for 40 years? We have a good idea, don't we? Because it was written down for us. We're going to read it. The 40 years of wandering around. Go here, go there. No food, no water. Too much food, wrong water. Wrong food. All these various complaints. What's this crazy stuff from the heaven coming down, little puff balls? Tastes strange. What is this? We have a general idea because it was written down for us. So remember that way. Now, in the writing down, we can understand and read about the manna, right? We understand it describes what it is, what it looked like, even tells how it tasted, how they used it, what they did with it. Describes the meat they used, the birds, how they got them, how many died from it, all these various things happened. We understand the snake bites they had to deal with. We understand these things because we read about them. But we don't really read about that structure over there, do we? We don't read about what it's like to live in a tent for 40 years when they're accustomed to living in houses. In Egypt, they had houses, by the way. They may not have been big ones, they still had them. All of us have some house structure we live in, most of us do at least. Imagine you didn't have it. It's that experience we're trying to associate and God's trying to remember. Remember what their life was like, and that we complain, oh, look, how, I would never have complained like these people. Look, they complain about not having this, they complain about not having that, and oh, they wish they had this. They complain to God all the time. Don't they get it? Really, Daniel?
We would complain.
You go live in a house like that for 40 years. It's raining, it's cold, it's hot, all the various things going on, the bugs, the dust, the dirt. Shower? That's next year's. Bummer. And yeah, what's that? Here's your shovel. Oh, you don't have a shovel? That's all right. Here's your stick. We didn't make shovels yet. Here's your stick to dig a hole. Oh, crud. Now, that experience. Now put yourself in their mindset. Okay, now that I'm living like this, what's life like? Now I'm used to a house. With a fireplace and a door and windows. No indoor plumbing. But the sewer wasn't that bad. It wasn't that far away. Actually, I may have had I had some indoor plumbing. That's right. There was some indoor plumbing. You're right. There was some of you. There was some. I even had some of those things, and now I'm living with none of that. Now, I'm not complaining about all my living experiences, but God, at least get the food right, okay? At least do that part. Now we understand what it's like for them and why they complained so easily. It wasn't that easy. It wasn't great of an experience. So what does God want you to remember? Oh, well, they complained. No. He remembered that part. He took care of that part. Remember their life. What life was like. An experience for 40 years. We have to experience it in October. Sometimes September for lucky. How about January? How's December sound? Yeah. How about when it's 105 degrees outside all day long? There is no air conditioning. There's no ice. The water's warm too. Sorry, guys. It's all hot. There's nothing else. It's just, how hot can you get? You can't take all your clothes off. All right, that's not legal. You're a little stuck there. It's not very pleasant either. Mind the bugs, the crawly things are biting you. Yeah, don't forget that too. There's no ointment. Sorry. Tough luck. It's not pleasant either. Those experiences we're trying to combine together and understand what it's like to live in a sukkah. And we'll do it for a week. Not for 40 years. So, hence, God says, remember them, not for God's sake, not for our sake, for remembering who they were, what they lived through. Now, God killed them all off, by the way. They complained too much. We're like, really, God? I complain without indoor plumbing. And he didn't give them that. And I would be complaining. I wouldn't last long, would I? I probably in the first iteration, the first week, I'd be, yeah, I'm done. I'd be out of it. Yes.
So this provokes us every year to make a decision for God or not for God.
It does.
The easy way of the homes and the house and the comfort and
the warmth, all the great things.
All the right things. Yep. But I mean, it goes beyond those things to who are we going to serve?
Right. Where is your priority?
And why are we serving this God?
What's so important about this memory God wants in us and is still inside of us to remember? Why is it so critical? What does it matter? There are a lot of people who suffered over the years. Generations ago, they suffered, they had miseries. No one knew what sewage was. Drink this. Don't drink that. Contamination. Who doesn't matter? Yes, it does matter, but they didn't know. People suffered over years. This particular generation, God wants to remember this group. Remember what this one went through. What they had to experience. And we do it through, obviously, the components God set aside to do this with. So it's a celebration, which we can, you know, drink a little bit extra and, you know, have a little more fun, make it a celebration to us, but it's still an unpleasant experience to remember these individuals as he was his purpose. Now, we've talked about other holy days and such over the years. I have a question for you in this context, which we had hinted on earlier as people had made, because they've gone through this for many years, I'm sure, putting up various things for Sukkot and studying these topics. Now, we understand certain basic things that when we're dealing with topics that we have a physical explanation thing, like an object. For example, as mentioned earlier, we have the holiday of Passover, right? We have an example of, you know, bitter herbs. We have the example of unleavened bread. We have an advantage in that in our New Testament authors helped explain conceptually to internalize what those external things mean. So the idea of what unleavened bread means versus leavened bread, the whole leavening thing, it's sin, makes you puff yourself up, blah, blah, blah. We get that point, right? Well, Sukkot's no different. So we have our physical objects that our New Testament authors were able to expound and explain what it meant on a spiritual and internal level to explain what this experience is supposed to be like, to remind us of. Now, mind you, I'm not diminishing or minimizing any way God's instruction about remembering what our forefathers went through. That's important. That was a command to remember what that life was like. It's an important component to this. But on top of that, to help internalize what this experience is like on a spiritual level, our New Testament authors help in Corinthians and Romans and such to discuss what it means on a more basic level to a human being, a man, woman, or child. Now, I'm going to explain this in simple terms for you, so hopefully I don't lose anybody. When we build one of those structures, note there are a bunch of plants and such we cut off and put on there, right? Now, we had to go out, kill the plant part by cutting it off, and strap it to that thing, didn't we? Is there any life in that structure? Not if I cut it, it's still dead, right? So I took a living thing, actually a few living things, some of the people did too, there's some other parts of it, I didn't do all of them. But living things, killed them to make something out of them that we can use. Now, I have a question for conception. Just think about yourself for the moment. Imagine you are, just momentarily think, you are the sukkah that was just built. You are that thing. Not the individual, you are that thing. So you're sitting on the wall, you're a bush, a plant, a tree, and you just experienced death to be made into something. Now, you didn't kill yourself. Something greater than you killed you to make this structure, right? A human being did it. They built this thing. They molded something which you weren't before, but you were converted to something which you weren't, and now you are this, right? Now you, as a dead thing, who do not have the power to do any of that, even when you were alive, you couldn't do that. But now you're dead, you still can't do it for certain. Can you comprehend the power that thing that did this to you has? No. Because you can't understand the strength and power it takes to kill you and make you into something that is useful to that being, right? You don't have that. Hence the example of the potter and the pottery. Now, on a human level, when we look at this thing, though that cannot comprehend us, is a plant structure. We can walk into it and we are alive, but it is not. It is dead. So we are walking into a dead thing that we built. We made it useful to us, right? We killed something to make it useful to us. And we walk into it. Now, you, right, so if you are the wall, you're one of the bushes, you're seeing this, something that you cannot comprehend comes in amongst you and dwells. You cannot understand this thing because it's beyond your comprehension. It has hands, it has feet, it can move wherever it wants to. Plants can't do that. It can go wherever it pleases at a moment's notice. Plants can't do that. So it cannot understand you, yet you come into it and you live or you dwell in it for a period of time. So you've been made, you as a plant, have been made useful to this being which is far superior to you. Now, translate up one level higher, which you all know where I'm going with this. So you are a human being. Can you comprehend the God that's going to dwell in you? No, you really can't. And we think about him, but he says this, he says that. But we can't actually experience because we can't do what he can do. A plant cannot make themselves into that structure. They cannot kill themselves and build that out of their wasted body. But we can build it. We cannot do what God does with us. So we cannot comprehend his ability to do it. We try, but we can't. Yeah, we're in our box. We have a defined idea of what we can and cannot do. We try to use our terms, our understanding, to understand what he's doing with inside of us. So God can take our body and do the same thing that structure is. Make us something which we're not. Make us useful to him. And we cannot comprehend him, and yet the process of doing so, it kills us. Doesn't it? And the whole point, our objective of doing this, is this superior being is making something which we are not to be useful to him. So God dwelling within inside each person is actually an incomprehensible thing, isn't it? I'll give you the example of why it's incomprehensible. Which thought of yours in your head right now belongs to you versus him? Can you distinguish them? No, you can't. You can't distinguish which one's his thought, which one's your thought. Now, you know which ones are for certain are yours. But the ones that are good, are they yours or are they his? At which point he said, okay, I'm taking over your personality temporarily. I'll do this. Now I'll go back to you. And now you go back, take over again. It doesn't work that way. So we can't actually comprehend having a dual mind within inside of us. Now we understand the idea of having dual inclinations. We want to do this versus not want to do that. Which one is actually God speaking or just God influencing our personal thoughts? Well, it's really hard to distinguish them. You know, well, this one, check mark, that's his. That one, check mark, that's mine. You can't really do that very well, can we? So we try to understand it, but we really can't truly comprehend it and how it's supposed to work in that fashion. Yes, Tammy.
It's usually after the fact. Hindsight is 20/20. Because like when in the New Testament, when we read that, we're told that if we are brought before kings and governors and so on, don't worry about what you're going to say, because when the time comes, the Holy Spirit will give you what to say.
Right.
So it's in hindsight usually that we realize, ooh.
That wasn't me.
That couldn't have been me.
Because I didn't know that's those things. Right. We have an idea in that point. If that happened, right, to me, it never occurred to me personally. Maybe it has some of you. I've never had to experience that scenario. But obviously some appear to have done so in a historical context of what they describe. So, but it's difficult to understand the idea, though. But we can see it on a physical level, that little structure. We can actually see what it's like, though we can't experience it in the way the structures, because we aren't actually plants, we're humans. But if we can see, put ourselves in a plant's position, what did I just go through to get to here? We can understand that concept, and we can understand the idea of what God's going to put us through to get us where he wants us to be. The same parallel idea between us building a sukkah through our strength versus him building us through his strength. It's a little different, isn't it? Both, however, result in our death when he said and done. He says, now you're useful to me. Unfortunately, now you're no longer alive. But anyway, yes, Ellie.
We do understand allegory.
Right. Symbolism, allegorical, this is what we're doing with right now. It's a symbol. We understand the symbols. Hence, as Jeff pointed out earlier, and somebody else did too, I think, is that we can experience things, and the physical doing helps explain the spiritual nature of it. We just talked about this at Atonement. The act of the out of mouth precedes the heart, right? If you do something over and over and over again, your heart tends to follow. It may not be immediate, but it tends to follow. If you do something evil over and over and over again, your desire will tend to follow the evil thing. If you do something good over and over and over again, your desire will tend to follow the thing good. Not that we don't have control over it. No, it's the tend to follow. It will desire to follow the same thing. If you realize, if you realize how much work raising a child was going to be, you say, you know what? Hawaii looks good. We'll go there instead. But over time of taking care of the child over and over and over again, and they grow and all the labor and effort put into it, some of us earlier than others a little later, it's okay. Your heart tends to follow toward the child and you love it that much more. The amount of work put into it, your heart tends to follow that thing. So it's no different. So God built us that way. He knows us that. Hence, every year, build something. And we tend to remember it because our actions, our heart tends to follow. Our understanding expands. Yes, it's an abundance of work. Or yes, it's very difficult to do. Or yeah, that's a miserable experience for 40 years. But the value of it, you realize, wait a minute, there is something far bigger here that I didn't understand. I could read about it. I could talk about it. I couldn't experience it. The experiencing fleshed out my understanding. So we can go on here. Let's jump through to some of the New Testament authors about this topic of Sukkot. I'm a little late on time. I'll do okay. I'll be done relatively quickly. I'm going to skip certain sections, so forgive me about that. Jump to, let's see here. I'm going to jump to, there are four different verses that I normally would have gone to, but I'm going to weed out a couple of them. And we're going to jump to a few basic ones just to refresh your memory on the importance of what this is supposed to mean, as Rose mentioned earlier. Go to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Rose had mentioned this briefly as she referred to her outfit addressing her sukkah. 1 Corinthians 3. I can find 1 Corinthians. Something I'm not very good at is knowing where all my books are. I was supposed to memorize that, but my parents did a terrible job teaching me to memorize the Bible structure. No, Mom and Dad, I didn't tell you that. You didn't hear anything. They didn't teach you either? Yeah, you didn't teach John either. Come on. 1 Corinthians 3. Let's see here. I was jumping to I'm going to read a couple different spots. This is first in Corinthians, just one of the places I'm going to go to. I'll go to chapter 6 in a minute. So 1 Corinthians 3, in verse 5 says, this, we're, like most things in the New Testament, we tend to jump in the middle of conversations. I don't like doing that, but sometimes for the sake of time, I'm short, and that's what I wound up doing. So 1 Corinthians chapter 3, jumping right in the middle of his conversation in verse 5, it says, who then is Paul and who is Apollos, what ministers through whom you believed as the Lord gave to each one? I planted, Apollos water, but God gave the increase. No, stop a minute. The analogy he just threw up there, the whole I planted, Apollos water, God gave, that analogy is, should be reminding you of a plant, right? Okay, we got that? Okay, good. Just make sure we're on that page. So then neither of us who plants is anything, nor he who waters, but God who gives the increase. Now he who plants, he who waters are one. Each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field. You are God's building. According to the grace of God, which is given to me, a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, another builds on it, but let each one take heed how he builds on it. For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus the Christ. Now if anyone builds his foundation with gold or silver, precious stone, wood or hay or straw, each one's work will become manifest, for the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. If anyone's work which he has built on it endures, he will receive reward. If anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss. But he himself will be saved, yet so as through fire. Do you not know that you are the temple of God, and the Spirit of God dwells in you? If anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy, which temple you are. So you see what he's trying to talk about here, the analogy we got, the whole idea of God making the increase, you're like a plant being watered, you're a temple or building that God's building inside of you. We get the idea, right? You get the pretty basic principle. So in this same idea, which we're discussing, which is the topic of Sukkot, we have a symbol we can look at over there. We can see, okay, what does this thing look like? Remind us that God is one building us, hence the whole what we're planted and watered, what God makes us increase, produce good fruit, all that kind of good stuff, yada, yada, yada. But the idea is that if we're comparing ourselves to a structure, he tells us to remember what the structure is, compare ourselves to it, we understand a little bit about what God's doing with us, right? As I mentioned earlier about the idea of trying to understand the plant, trying to understand the human who built it, saying that God, or us trying to understand the God who's building us. The idea is a little bit vague, a little fuzzy. We kind of comprehend a little bit about it because eventually we know we're going to perish and this body won't be around anymore. But what did God build out of us? What did the structure look like before it was tested through fire? Right? Who's going to get tested through fire? All of us are. What do we look like? We'll find out, won't we? We'll find out. Find out what structure did he build? Is it a weak one? Is it a strong one? Well, I don't know about you, and you don't know about me. God's the one who knows. So when he tests, he finds out, how strong was it? Was the foundation good? Was it nurtured along its growth pattern? Was it neglected instead? What happens when a tree or bush is neglected? What happens to them? They tend to wither and die. They get really dry. When fire comes, what happens to a dry bush? Yeah. Now, what happens to a bush that's really, really well watered? It takes a lot of heat to burn it, doesn't it? It singed. It takes a lot of heat. It can withstand a lot. So being planted alone is not good enough, is it? The foundation alone isn't good enough, is it? I can plant a seed in a really good field that's well, perfect and wonderful and never water it again. It never receives moisture, nothing at all. What happens? It might germinate. Might. Not worth much, is it? So we have this idea that what God's putting in through us is it's not just the structure being built, but how it's being cared for. Now, I have a question for you. Now, you don't answer this out loud. Think internally, okay? Who's responsible for the watering of your structure? You're not supposed to answer it. Yeah. Yeah. So the responsibility of taking care of what God planted, does that fall upon the person who planted the idea? No, it doesn't. It falls upon the person who's growing, because we can do that. We can actually water ourselves. Now, can we make ourselves increase? No, we can water ourselves and let God do the increase. So we have that idea. So let's move on. The next slide you want to jump to. I see I can go back to, I'm going to jump to Corinthians. I like this one, so I'm doing it anyway. 1 Corinthians 15. You know this, I'm sure you know this section probably by heart. 1 Corinthians 15, jump to verse 35. Verse 35 of 1 Corinthians chapter 15. So eventually we obviously will be tested in some fashion. We can all debate what the tests look like, whether it's for person A versus person B. They all be, will make, their tests may vary some, depending on what kind of structure they're built. But 1 Corinthians 15 discusses a few things. Chapter 15. Verse 35 says, but some will say, how are the dead raised up? And with what body do they come? Foolish one, what you sow is not made alive unless it dies. And what you sow, you don't sow that body which shall be, but mere grain, perhaps a wheat or some other grain. But God gives it a body as he pleases, and to each seed its own body. All flesh is not the same flesh, but there's one kind of man, or the kind of flesh of beasts, of fish and birds and such. There are also celestial bodies and other stuff of the sky, blah, blah, blah. Verse 14, or 41. There's one glory of the sun, of the moon, the glory of the stars, all differ from each other, star in glory and brightness. So also the resurrection of the dead, the body is sown in corruption, the days in incorruption. Stop there for a minute. What's he just saying? You don't look today like you're going to look like tomorrow.
More wrinkles?
Yeah, more wrinkles, right. I have a question. I've asked you this before over the years and time. Where were you in your walk with God, if you're this old, 20 years ago? Are you the same place you were then as you are now? Are you even close?
No, farther down the road.
A little older? Yeah. Our walks change over time, don't they? Our understanding changes, doesn't it? Right? What we thought was right. Whoops, got that wrong. Move on. I got rid of that part because I was screwed up then. Or we think that is right now. We used to think was wrong before, but now we think it's right. Tomorrow we might think what is right now might be wrong. We change. So we don't look the same as we did 20 years ago. Some of us 10 years ago, if you're not that old. How about looking back 40 years ago? When you were children? Do you look the same? No, actually, I know I don't. I have a lot more hair. It's white, too. I don't look the same as I did when I was a child. I have a lot more hair of it. Lots of hair. So I'm different. So I know my body changes. And of course, his example, his citation here is pretty obvious. When you plant a seed, you're not growing seeds. You're growing plants. So when you're planted and you're watered, you're not going to look like the seed that was put into you, right? If I put a cherry seed in the ground, I'm going to spit out cherries. It spits out a tree. It doesn't look the same. It looks different. That's the basic idea. So we know whatever test we're going to go through, we will not look the same when we're done. How many of you have burned a tree branch of some form in your life? When it was done being burned, it looked the same as it did before or after? Or before? No, it really doesn't. It doesn't look the same. Now, what if you accidentally burnt it and you pulled it out? It looks a little different, a little black at certain spots, but it doesn't quite look the same. So what you go through, whatever the experience is, it's going to change you permanently. You will not look the same when you're done. Okay? Let's jump through it. So it says, verse 44, where I left off, verse 43? Where was I? 42, okay. So all is resurrection of the dead, the body is in corruption, the raised in corruption. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown in natural body, it is raised in spiritual body. There's a natural body and a spiritual body. And so it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being, the last man, Adam, became a living, life-giving spirit. However, the spiritual is not first, but the natural, and afterward the spiritual. The first one was the earth made of dust. The second man is from heaven. As was the man of dust, so are those who are made of dust. As the heavenly man, so are those who are heavenly. And as we have borne the image of man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly man. This is a brother that all flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does corruption inherit incorruption. So you are designed to go through this experience. You're designed to live, to be watered, and die, and turn into something else. Hence, every plant was, every booth we build, every tree says, but I liked that branch, as I whack it off. It was designed to be cut off. What happens if you don't prune a tree? It doesn't bear fruit, does it? And when the ones that do bear fruit, the fruit is really heavy, and what happens? The tree prunes itself. Oh, look, I lost a few branches. Our neighbor had that with their peach tree recently. That's what happens. My fig tree almost blew over too, or fell down. Same problem. It got too heavy, and it couldn't withstand it. So we expect the correction throughout the watering process to alter us as time goes on. If we don't get through it, we will perish. We won't make it through. Some part of us will be a more painful experience of our losses. So it's okay to go through this process, but we know that the physical is supposed to go through first, so we expect our physical life to teach us what our spiritual life will look like, right? Because the spiritual comes second. It's a second place. And we think, oh, but the spirit should be first. No. God designed the spiritual ideas to come later. So the physical goes through first to teach you the process. Since we learn about sukkahs, we learn about the holy days, we learn about our God through our physical life, through the words he spoke to us, the goal is to change something which we are not. Better, different, hopefully better. We go through that experience of correction or of burning to see what we turn into. All right? Let's jump to Romans 12. I will probably end there. Oh, okay, Romans 12. Romans 12, of course, I'm sure many of you know this verse, like heart as well. Romans 12, starting verse 1, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercy of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, a holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God. For I say through the grace given to me, that everyone who is among you not to think of himself more high than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt each one a measure of faith. For as we have many members in one body, but all members do not have the same function, so we, being many, are one body in Messiah and individual members of one another. Have different gifts, I'm going to go through all the gifts of prophecy and such. So in our experience, does a fig tree produce apples? Why not? It should. I'm shocked.
Wow.
You mean you don't make apples too?
We're not meddling with those figs.
Right. Right. The point is, obviously, present yourself what you can do and let God decide whether it was good enough. If you don't produce figs, don't worry about it. Because oranges don't have to produce figs. Right? Lemon trees aren't supposed to produce grapes. They're not compatible. Your fruit, what you present to God, so God planted you and was watered, and he made you increase whatever fruit you're supposed to make. Don't be stressed about somebody else's fruit. He looks better. She looks worse. He looks like that. Oh, his tastes terrible. No, it doesn't worry. His too sour. No, it's not none of your business. What do you produce? What's your fruit look like? What God's building in you is what your sukkah, what your dwelling period, what your clothing is covering up. That's what God made. And he'll increase that accordingly. And no matter how hard we try, we don't look the same as somebody else. Which is fair. Well, can a pinky be upset with the thumb? No. Pinky said you should be more like me. Doesn't know you should be more like me. They have an argument. Ridiculous, right? Should a foot be like a shoulder? No. So understand, our structures are not designed to look the same. And I've yet to see two sukkahs look the same. I've tried. It doesn't work. Yes, Jeff, you comment on.
I was just saying that these days, I guess the pinky and the thumb could be upset about what it's become.
Fair enough. They can agree on a disagreement there. Certain things they didn't want. But so we have the idea that God gave to us, the symbols we give, and he says in sukkahs in particular, so sukkah in particular, we have components designed to remember what experience was once like to a group of people who we never met. And we never will meet. Well, okay, we could argue with the whole death, spirit, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what it's going to look like because I don't know who made it, who didn't make it. But assuming we don't get to meet all of them, we don't know anything about them. That was written down. So as we'll experience what their life was like so we can understand more about who they were and even why they complained. God doesn't like complainers, neither do I, but he's a lot more harsher than I am. So even why they complained, understand what that life was like. And then we look back and say, well, I would never do that. Really? Sure about that? Well, I'm better than that. Really? Are you? Are you really? Well, I produce better fruit, look, don't I? Okay. You want to test that theory? No. I don't. I don't want to test that theory. I try to produce whatever fruit I can, realizing that for me to look back at the people in the past, say, well, he did this or she did that. Look how awful these people were. But I wasn't there. I didn't experience that. Most of us, I think, would probably have to say, God, 40 years, really? Do I have to? Is there any other way? How about I go on ahead and find a good hotel room while I'm waiting? I don't mind. I'll pay for it. It's okay. Yeah, a hot tub sounds good. I'm being honest, right? Can I at least have indoor plumbing, at least? something for the sewage I have to deal with? That's our nature. It's too much work. I don't want to deal with that kind of life. And yet we experience and understand, all right, God says, wait a minute. You have to understand what these people experienced. But we can say, well, they produced bad fruit. God killed them off. Yeah, but you would have produced just as bad. And the important thing, we understand that we produced just as bad because humans don't change. Only God can change us. So if we produce the exact same experience and gone through the same thing and produce the same part of complaining, God, this is hard. Yes, it is hard. Hence, we're living 4,000 years later. Don't look too harsh about the people back then. Because you wouldn't have done any better. Might be worse, exactly. Wait, we are really spoiled, right? We go back and say, wait a minute. They probably didn't even have a tenth of the things that we even, think about, 10 things that we have. It's very, very different. So when we look at our Bibles, look at our Torahs, look at our of individual people, individual sukkahs that God built, and their experience of good and bad, evil, good, whatever, all the mixes, right and wrong experiences, to say, well, this person did something wrong here. Yes, that's true. But the action is what you're focused on, not the man. But what about Ahab? He was a terrible man. Yeah, but it's the actions you may look at, not the man. Even Jezebel? Yes, even Jezebel. Each sukkah doesn't look the same.
Each sukkah has a purpose.
Each sukkah has a purpose. And the end of it, whatever fire that thing goes through, whatever burned up ashes, which mostly stuff probably went into the recycle bin, whatever it looks like will look nothing like what I saw. So even the Jezebels look nothing like what we read about. Whatever her experience was, whatever, maybe she had repentance as she was falling down the tower and said, oops, this was not what I wanted. We don't know. Whatever she looks like now is not what she looked like what we read about. So every experience that we read about has nothing to do with the individual, what they turned into when they died. Because God tested it, and God said, it looks like this. And we say, what's that? I've never seen that before. Because you weren't looking for that. Yes, Ellie.
You know, it's common now, because we have so much to think, and especially young people growing up that have a lot, that the way the things are should always be good. It should always be, we should have everything. Everything should be perfect, or the way we perceive it. And it's really hard if you don't have to deal with loss or lack or inadequacy. You have to teach yourself in this life or in America, a good part, what to do without something you could go get, but figure out a way to do it yourself, because life doesn't always even put us in that situation anymore. Then when calamity comes, we are really bent, because I'm not supposed to have to put up with this. I'm not supposed to have to deal with this. Oh, that's a really dangerous situation. I told you kids when you're growing up, even God doesn't like a complainer.
You should also tell us the order of the Bible books. Sorry. I just tease you. Any questions or comments regarding this? Our Sukkah study? Yes, Kate.
I was just thinking, actually, how funny it is. The idea of a tree.
A tree, yes.
Right? And you cut it down, and you can see its life. Mm-hmm. And while they might have looked similar, you can see if it struggled for years to stay alive, if it was in a drought, if it survived fire, if it, whatever it is, and it can look like this beautiful tree or not. Mm-hmm. But in its death, you can see its life and what it went through. Mm-hmm. And you don't know that.
Right.
I mean, right? Like, they can all look alike, mm-hmm. but the story of the inside of the tree mm-hmm. is unique to that tree yeah. or that area and what they went through. And I just thought, like, huh. Yeah. That really is us.
That is. The outside, we look like what we wish to look like. That's what we are on the inside. Any questions or comments? We'll close the prayer then. Almighty God, great Father, thank you for our Sukkot, our time to worship and to pray and to study and to listen to your voice. Father, please teach us well to learn what is good and right in your eyes. We always follow you wherever you lead us, even though it may be cold and unpleasant. Father, we know that you are with us. It comforts us. May you bless us, Father. We share what is good and right and teach and to show our generations to come that they will follow you too. We glorify you, Father, and praise you in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info, hallel.info.